Hi everyone, David here. Thank you so much for listening to What Matters. We hope you enjoy the show. Before we begin, if you and maybe some of your colleagues would like premium access to the What Matters podcast and want to read or listen to the essential in-depth journalism from Foresight Climate and Energy, make sure to subscribe. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightdk.com/subscribe to find out more. Hello and welcome to What Matters, the podcast from Foresight Climate and Energy. My name is David Weston and joining me this week is Michaela Hall from Agora Energy Vendor. Hi Michaela, are you well?
Yes, I guess it's equally hot everywhere, so equally spread suffering, but fine. Thanks for asking.
Great. Yes, yeah, very warm at the moment, very sticky last night, but we'll carry on regardless. Jan sadly can't be with us this week as he was called away on short notice to an event in Lisbon. So we'll ask him all about that on his return. Europe can create a clean energy power system by 2035. This ambitious claim has been made in a new report by climate think tank Ember. A power system dominated by wind and solar in Europe can be achieved within 15 years at no extra cost above stated plans. But while it is possible, according to Ember, is it feasible? Our guest this week is Chris Roslow from Ember, the lead author of the report. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Really nice to be here. Thank you.
Chris, could you maybe briefly explain the conclusions of the report under your findings? Around 95% of Europe's power system can use clean energy. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That we find that decarbonizing Europe's power system by 2035 can be achieved. So if I could break down this main findings into three parts, the first thing to say is 2035 power system decarbonization, we think, is necessary for the Paris Agreement, for the 1.5 degree C goal, and it works. You know, this is underpinned by very detailed hourly modeling, country by country, of the whole European power system. So 2035, we think, is a really important date, and we think we've provided the evidence here to show that that is a workable system. So that's the first part. You touched on the costs in your introduction just then, and I think that is a really a crucial piece of this analysis. We find that indeed the power system can be largely decarbonized by 2035 and simultaneously expanded at no extra cost. And that is compared to the business as usual paths, like you say, the kind of stated policies. This is a really surprising finding. You know, how can that be with all this extra wind and solar and grids that need to be built? And I think to summarize, to simplify, the answer really is in the price of wind and solar. You know, everyone knows that the price of those technologies has fallen off a cliff in the past 10 years, and the forecasts are that it will get even cheaper. So that's really at the core of our findings. And then the third part of this requires us to take a little step back from the power sector. So I've said that this decarbonization, I've claimed it can be done at no extra cost. But when we zoom out of the power sector, what we're actually modeling here is an expanded power supply, which can displace fossil fuels in other parts of the economy, in heating, in transport. We're assuming that we can electrify these sectors even further. And when we factor in the displaced fossil fuels, we actually find that the savings Europe can make adds up to €1 trillion by 2035. So the power system, we think, can be decarbonized at no extra cost. And then when you look at the wider picture, you're actually saving costs by 2035. So to kind of try to wrap all that up in one kind of summary, I would say acting faster to decarbonize the power sector, it quickly pays off. Or to flip that around, you know, delaying action will actually cost Europe more.
Some of the conclusions from the report, annual growth in wind and solar capacity needs to quadruple by 2025 compared to the last decade. Coal needs to be phased out by 2030. Unabated gas needs to be reduced to less than 5% of generation by 2035. Doubling interconnection capacity by 2035. No new baseload of unabated gas plants need to be commissioned beyond those expected by 2025. Your modeling shows this is feasible and cost effective, but is it realistic, especially given the current crises of energy prices and Russia's aggression towards Ukraine and everything and the supply chain crunch that we're seeing around the world?
Yeah, you're completely right to point out that we're setting some pretty big challenges here for the power sector and for the infrastructure required. On the point about the current situation, you know, the fossil fuel crisis, the gas crisis that we're in right now, I mean, just the very first thing to say on that, I think, is the high price of fossil fuels and the volatility of those prices, the security risk that reliance on fossil fuels presents to Europe only strengthens the case for accelerating decarbonization. But of course, it would be inappropriate not to talk about the very real challenges on the ground of actually making this happen. So if I could take these technologies, if you like, one by one, I think it's appropriate to start with wind and solar, because these really are the key technologies to making this happen. And you're right. So what we find is deployment, so the number of gigawatts added per year needs to at least quadruple kind of very quickly. And we need to sustain those levels as Europe until 2035. The end result of that in 2035 will be a much radically bigger fleet of wind farms and solar farms. And there are very real barriers to that happening right now. But the good news is that we have a pretty good idea, you know, as Europe, about what these barriers are. So for wind and solar, there are some shared issues. So what we hear loud and clear from the industry and from researchers on this is that the permitting is a huge issue. It's just too slow. The procedures are too complicated, and there's a lack of capacity at the kind of local level to process these projects quickly enough. So that's a clear area of focus that every member state, every nation in Europe needs to address. The second big challenge is grid connection. So in some countries in Europe, there are projects queuing up to be added to the grid that they want to start providing this clean energy, clean, cheap energy to the grid, but they've been prevented from doing so by a lack of access to the grid. And I think it's instructive to reflect on why that's the case. And I would argue that that's a result of a lack of foresight and a lack of anticipatory investment in grids in the past, you know, few years, past decade. I think, and this is why I really want to emphasize, you know, the direction of travel and the importance of expanding wind and solar, because grid expansion has a lead time. You know, these investments don't happen overnight. So this expansion of wind and solar really needs to be in the planning right now, and the appropriate investments and the improvements to permitting need to be happening now to enable this expansion to happen in a timely way to get us to this 2035 clean power system. So that's the wind and solar challenge. And I'll quickly cover the fossil fuel side as well. So you're right that we find that coal has to be phased out of the European system by 2030. This is not a new finding. We've known for a while. I think European civil society has been collectively calling for this for a while, to be aligned with 1.5 degrees C as Europe. And 23 countries now have announced plans to go beyond coal, to phase out coal in their countries. And what we see actually is most of those pledges are by 2030. Some of them are a bit later. I'm thinking of Germany, Czechia, not quite meeting that requirement, but there is a trend here. So what we've seen over the past 5 or 10 years is that once a country sets that direction to move beyond coal, the date often creeps forward. So once the direction of travel is set, things happen. Wind and solar economics are so favorable that actually that transition tends to happen faster than the kind of more cautious government announcements that's made in the first place. And I don't think the situation right now where we're seeing a mini resurgence in coal in Europe, I don't think that changes that longer term direction of travel.
Can I come in? I'm sorry, can I come in on this? Because
yes,
I just saw Ember tweeting about this, no? Because everywhere you read now these days, coal is having a comeback, you know, emissions go up in the power sector. And then Ember tweeted this morning, coal is not making a comeback. in Europe and that you identified four countries, like amongst them Germany and Austria, who want to come back with coal, but you see only a limited impact in terms of GHG emission. Can you specify a bit more why you are so optimistic and how much increase you see? Because I vaguely remember having seen also a bit other figures, but please go ahead. What's behind this?
Yeah, of course. I think it's important to be honest about this moment that we're in, and we are seeing, as I said, a mini resurgence in coal in Europe. But we're pretty confident that it's a short term effect. What's driving it is the rapid need to decouple from Russian fossil fuel supplies. You know, there's obviously a big kind of rearrangement happening now in how Europe imports its energy. So there will be this year, perhaps next year as well, an increased coal burn. But what we're not seeing is in the longer term, we're not seeing a significant backsliding on the targets in the power sector. So some other research Ember published a couple of weeks ago now found that basically over the last 1 or 2 years, the renewables targets for the power sector in different countries across Europe have actually increased. So that direction, that progress is still being made in terms of the ambition on the 2030 timescale. And this was...
But can you be, pardon me, can you be specific about how much emission in the short term will increase in Europe? Did you model that?
No, we haven't modeled that immediate effect. I think I've seen estimates of around 5% increase in power sector emissions from this switch from gas back to coal.
But you assume it will be temporary?
We do. We think it's temporary. We think it's temporary and not structural.
Mm-hmm. Can I come back to your study again with a question? Your 2030-50 decarbonizing power. And just to mention here, Agora Energiewende actually did similar work, but only for Germany, also just now. So here and there, I might be comparing a little bit, but I can see they basically come to very similar results, obviously, like how much gas is left at the end, how they run, etc. No? I guess the German case is a bit more specific because of our particular double challenge with coal and nuclear, which you cannot transfer one by one to all of Europe. So I think it's a nice compliment to have your EU study. On the grid part, you talked about it already. So your additional investment needs, they do include, I assume, the grid expansion, which I guess will also be quite massive. Can you differentiate between power and grid? In the German study, we come to the conclusion we need 40% more grid. And I mean, you talked already about several challenges. For me, that seems to be a massive one. Is it similar in your study?
I completely agree that grids is a massive challenge. In our modeling, just for a bit of background, the object of our modeling is the whole European system. So we don't provide estimates of extra grid requirements, you know, within countries internally. We do come to a number on the increase needed at the kind of whole interconnected European system level. And what we see there is, I think it was mentioned already, a doubling of that capacity between countries by 2035. The direction of travel is to expand interconnection. You know, that's some good news, but we find that an even higher expansion than is planned would be optimal.
Yeah, and you hinted at it already that the planning currently doesn't look so much in the future. No, so that basically it's planned on stated policies at the moment in the EU. And so the benefits of, you know, something that massively higher offshore wind capacity would need isn't coming out yet. And so I was wondering in your modeling exercise, because obviously it's always inherently difficult to predict the future, but in particular for the power sector, how did you deal with, you know, storage, flexibility, innovation? What were your assumptions there? Because I assume you don't just want to take today's world and add massive renewables. So how did you, what's the way to do this? Like, Yeah, exactly. Like you're assuming some more flexibility. Yeah, it would be nice just to understand better. I'm not a modeler. I was always on the sideline of the modeling. For me, it was always a bit of a black box.
Sure, I'm happy to dive in. I mean, what I want to avoid doing is getting into a conversation about a specific technology, because, you know, it's quite appealing to some to imagine that a certain technology will come along and completely save us with this. But I think it may be more instructive to talk about the roles that we need for technologies in the future, in this power system in the future. You're completely right that our exercise here was not just to decarbonize the power system as it is today, but as I said earlier, expand that power system to provide more electricity for electric vehicles and heat pumps and electrification of industry. So we have kind of this dual challenge of expanding the power system and decarbonizing. We were very aware of this issue of, you know, obviously wind and solar are variable sources. So there's flexibility needed in the system at various timescales. We need technologies that fit different profiles, that fill different niches in that future power system. And the approach we took was not to pick the winners of that kind of race, that kind of technology race, but to essentially try to find out what the trade-offs are between the different options. So, of course, the model includes the technologies that you would expect to see, like battery storage, like pumped hydro storage. Also, I think our modeling is a bit unique, or at least rare, in the sense that we also include a role for green hydrogen and the kind of interactions between that and the power system. So I said I don't want to talk about any particular technology, but I might break my rule here and just say that the green hydrogen kind of life cycle fits very nicely with a high wind and solar power system, because if we expand the wind and solar fleet, as I described, you know, we'll end up with a much larger fleet. And at many, many times in the year, that will provide a lot more energy than we need. So imagine a winter storm coming into the North Sea, and the wind turbines there are harvesting all this energy. And it's a lot more than we need in that moment. So then it gets stored, it gets turned into green hydrogen by electrolyzers. It can be stored over long time scales relatively cheaply, and then burned through turbines at a later stage when we need it. So that's our kind of seasonal energy storage solution in this. But we also need storage at the hourly level, flexibility at the hourly level, and at kind of weekly timescales as well. And I'm happy to go into how they look in our model, but yeah, maybe I'll hand back to you.
Thanks. Since you broke your rule already. But so coming back, because you said we need to quadruple wind and solar in Europe to get to 35. Is this roughly consistent with what we said in Repower, where the Europe needed to go from basically 350 gigawatts installed, and then somewhere 900 something, so close to a terawatt hour, by 2027 or end of this decade. Is this a trajectory, or do we need more? So your quadrupling figure, if I remember correctly, you said you need quadrupling basically from now on already. So if in that case, I think if you look at all these electrolyzers, what they will need and what you see for accelerated power decarbonization, I mean, there is a bit of a competition on the renewables, right? Does it all add up?
It does add up. It does add up. So we in our exercise, we provide we made sure that this system that we are building and simulating can provide enough green hydrogen for use in other sectors, as well as a use in the power sector. And actually, the use of it in the power sector is relatively low. On the comparison between Repower EU, this is a really important point. I mean, I think it's important just to set the scene that the Repower EU plan is not yet policy. It's a proposal. So even if we think that this is
Well, yours is also not policy.
Of course. But the question is current policy enough? Absolutely not. But then is this vision from RePowerEU the right vision? I would say it goes a long way to closing the gap, specifically in terms of wind and solar. I think you're right that it gets Europe on the path to having, you know, a terawatt scale solar fleet by 2035. Obviously, it's only a vision for 2030. So what we would like to see is a more explicit commitment to 2035 decarbonized power, which is still limited. Some countries in Europe have gone that far. The UK has committed to that goal. Germany has committed verbally to that goal, but there seems to be a little bit of hesitation.
Kind of. Only at the G7.
Yes, the G7.
At home, not, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So we think there'd be real...
Well, we have the 80%.
The 80% by 2030.
We have the 80% by 2030. I think that we take seriously. And the thing with 2035, maybe not yet fully, I think one could summarize.
Michaela, what do you think this report, how it will be received in the halls of the European Commission, if you're Kadri Simpson or D2EU Jorgensen, and you see this report and you're looking at stated policies, how do you think this report will be taken in those
well,
offices?
I cannot speak for Ditte or someone, but I can speak as me being the former commission official and receiving Ember stuff. And I have to say they are usually clever in putting messages. So my hope would be that this would then also, because I remember, for example, one of the slogans where Ember was the first and which we then picked up happily in our briefings at the time was when you said for the first time in EU, renewables in the power sector overtook fossil fuels in the production. And that was a big moment. It was in 2020, so also helped obviously by the slowdown of the economy. But we were so happy to report this in, you know, all our renewables briefings. So voila, Ember was doing a good job recently. So on the decarbonization, I think this report will really be important because at the moment a lot is about short term. And I think there's a lot more to add. For example, you know, something that struck me, because every time we talked about power, it was always like, yeah, demand will increase and by 2050 is double. But we never talked actually about saving solutions in the power sector. And that's something that recently came, you know, like I saw a lot on Twitter, yeah, all these advertisement things, we could all remove all that waste. So be curious to hear in your modeling, did you also cut out a bit of, you know, inefficient electricity waste? Because maybe that buys us much more space also than just having this shocking, oh my God, we need to decarbonize and massively expand. No, I think the report is important. And I guess that's also why you did it and why we did it, to just keep this long-term vision. Because at the moment, it's a lot about short-term. And as you said, well, but let's not use side of the power sector because it helps indirectly with its emission and cost and import cost reductions in the other sectors. And this view, I think, is super important at the moment. I stop here, but I guess we'll come back also to all sorts of price interventions that we see. I wanted to ask you also what you think about this, if this is in line with your vision for 2035.
Yeah, Chris, let's start with the energy efficiency point. Have you factored that in? Buildings using less energy, more efficient processes, and obviously direct electrification will bring a lot of energy efficiency as well.
Indeed, yes. So there's a whole host of background assumptions in this work. What we wanted to do was to set out an optimistic vision, not just for the power sector, but also make sure we were being optimistic and aligned with what we think is needed in other sectors. So on building heating, yes, we do assume that the rate of renovation will increase in Europe and the rollout of heat pumps will accelerate. We focus mainly on heat pumps because we think this is the leading technology to decarbonize space heating. And if Jan was here, I'm sure he would agree. He's a fan of a heat pump, I believe. So we do assume that the space heating in buildings becomes dominated by heat pumps, and we factor that increase in demand into the model. On other efficiencies, we don't make radical assumptions about things like losses in the grid. You know, we're quite realistic that might persist. But yes, we do assume different levels of efficiency in other sectors. But I think it's important to emphasize that we don't actually just provide one pathway in this exercise, because we wanted to make the point that 2035 clean power can be achieved in a variety of situations. It's not dependent on one single technology or one single intervention elsewhere in the economy. You know, if we don't renovate buildings very quickly, it's not like this whole thing falls apart. You know, so we've done enough, I think, to show that this outcome for 2035 clean power is resilient to a lot of other assumptions and energy interventions in the rest of the economy. But yes, our main vision sees heating be electrified, industry be electrified, and transport be largely electrified as well.
Yeah. I think it's important also EMBA focuses generally, you focus on electricity only, you know, that's a bit your speciality. And I think, this message of it is electricity that is the basis and will extend into the other sectors, I think is really, really important for the systemic change, because otherwise we get this short-lived replace this fuel by this fuel, whereas if you change the entire system. So I guess this focus on electrification is a very welcome contribution to the debate, I think. But it also shows how massive it is. Huh? I mean, what it means, the IEA, I think, was the first one, no, that came out with this. The industrialized countries have to be decarbonized on their power systems by 2035, and then the developed, I don't know, I think early 40s or something, or 45. When was that? That was only a year ago, and it seemed shocking at the time because we just got round to, okay, coal phase out does kind of make sense. And now it's actually, it was at the G7, and you just said, so but it's not far away. It's really not far away at all. And this, I mean, I don't know. I think not everyone has understood just how much renewables we need as of yesterday. That for me is a little bit, yeah. And I don't know, Amber, do you have any, like, how can we communicate this better? I'm also looking a little bit, you know, at this really focus on hydrogen at the moment, where I also always think, yes, but the first step is renewables. Do you have any top professional tips on how do we get this message across, just how urgent it is to really get serious with the renewables? And do you see any place in Europe that actually is remotely on this deployment scale-up that we need?
Yeah, I'm really happy you raised the IEA report, because it lets me tell a bit of the background story of why we did this work in particular as well. So the IEA net zero scenario I think you're talking about was released. It was before COP26. So I think it was in the summer or spring of 2021. And
like a year ago, more or less. Yeah.
And we were actually already planning this study at that time, because these modeling exercises, unfortunately, take a long time and drag out. But we were really happy to see that top line message from the IEA that, like you say, advanced economies need to decarbonize power systems by 2035. And actually, the rest of the world is 2040. So, you know, that's a huge, huge challenge. That includes the likes of China, India, you know, a really big challenge. You know, Europe is already on the path, but you can't say that for everywhere in the world. So, this was a message that we picked up and we think is really important to emphasize. And one of the reasons we did this exercise for Europe is we wanted to kind of zoom in on that for Europe, almost downscale that finding and show in more detail how it can be done, what would be required, the renewables build out, the grids, and all this stuff. And I think actually, given that the rest of the world, according to the IEA, has to follow just 5 years later, you know, I actually think Europe has a real responsibility to show that this can work. You know, if it doesn't work, If we fail, it will send a catastrophic message to the rest of the world. You know, I'm thinking diplomatically here about announcements at the G7 and can we spread that to the G20 and et cetera, et cetera. It needs to actually be shown here. And I think that leads into the second part of your question about, are any countries getting serious about this and kind of showing it at a country level? I think you're in Europe, I think, yes, we have that. You know, in terms of the targets we have, we mentioned before the UK aiming for 2035 decarbonized power system. I think that's the biggest economy in Europe that has that goal at the moment. There are some other countries like Austria and I think Denmark who are also aiming for a similar date with their power systems. But in terms of deployment and planning, which is what actually really matters, you know, what's happening on the ground.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't want to be too biased towards the UK because we're not doing everything right on climate by far. But in the power sector, you know, we are seeing the volumes coming through of renewables. You know, there was a big Contracts for Difference auction last week that brought on more volume, and they're going to happen annually now. So there does seem to be some good progress being demonstrated in the UK. It obviously helps that we have a huge offshore wind resource that the same can't be said for all of Europe. So hopefully we'll come on to some of the challenges of deploying renewables, maybe to do with social resistance and things like that. But the UK is in a good position, but I would say it is on the ground making kind of appropriate progress in the short term.
I'm being outnumbered by the Brits today, I see. But it's totally fine to say it's going well in the UK. I can live with that. Just one question while thinking about the UK, just for our listeners, in your modeling, what is your assumption of the role of nuclear? Without wanting to go further into this toxic topic, but just generally as an information to the listeners, because very often we hear that we have to bring back the nuclear, otherwise we cannot do it. So what does your model say about this? And then we immediately change topics, ideally.
Oh, it wouldn't be a power sector discussion without the nuclear question. So let's get it over with. So I think the first thing to say is we approach this study objectively, without any preference for technologies, this technology over that technology. We tried as far as possible to let the economics dictate what happens here. And that also kind of generally reflects Ember's position as a think tank. You know, we take a data-driven, objective, pragmatic approach, in terms of these different technology options. We're not pro or anti-nuclear, despite what some people on Twitter might say. So we try to take that pragmatic approach, but we are radical in the sense that we want to cut emissions, you know, as rapidly as possible. So what nuclear is doing in our model, we assume that new nuclear, it could be built in Europe. We don't rule that out, but we only, in the computation of these pathways, that only occurs if it's the economic option. You know, these pathways are driven primarily by the least cost to the power system, which ultimately will filter through into lower bills. You know, at least that's how the theory works. So we don't see any new nuclear deployments in these decarbonization pathways. So that the role of nuclear decreases gradually over time. And what that tells us is that despite what some people say, you know, new nuclear plants are not essential for a decarbonized power system. They could be part of it, but it will cost a bit more. So that's, in a nutshell, what we find.
Hi everyone, David here again. Just a reminder that you and your colleagues can get premium access to the What Matters podcast and all of the in-depth journalism from Foresight Climate and Energy by subscribing. You can give us a try for 30 days for just €29, where you can access our website and audio app. Go to foresightdk.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes. Now, back to our conversation. is it not worth paying that little bit more for a firm power supply that that nuclear can provide?
Oh boy, this was not the deal.
Quickly, just playing devil's advocate here.
So we do experiment with this question a little bit in the modeling. So as well as our main result that I just described, that there's no new nuclear is needed. We don't assume that nuclear is actively phased out. You know, we assume that the plants will close when their time comes. So it's not as if we're turning off nuclear overnight. We also model what I would say is a best case scenario for nuclear. So we look across Europe and find the countries that are planning to expand nuclear, like Poland, Hungary, Czechia, the UK, France, etc. And we assume that this all goes ahead. So if we assume that this all goes ahead and it happens on time, which is a big assumption, and it happens on cost, which is a big assumption, then the actual cost of the overall pathway is quite similar to the one that includes no new nuclear. And that's because, yes, you have higher investment costs in nuclear because the plants, you know, they have high upfront costs, but you save a little bit elsewhere in the system. You know, you save a little bit on interconnection between countries because every country has that slightly higher firm contribution from its own domestic sources. You save a little bit from alternative firm sources like, for example, gas with CCS or hydrogen, those kind of alternative clean firm sources. Interestingly, you don't really save much from wind and solar. So the deployment level of wind and solar, it makes sense to build just as much, a little bit less, but basically the same. So what you can't say is, oh, we don't need to build all that wind and solar because we can have nuclear instead. Mm-hmm. Actually, they're not. Then you can't trade the two.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take you away from one controversial topic and bring you into another one. Has the recent vote on the EU taxonomy changed your opinion or put your conclusions into any jeopardy?
He will redo the report now.
I'll try to branch away from the report slightly if I can on this one. This is the EU giving the approval of gas power plants with some criteria as a sustainable investment. Speaking practically about this, the criteria that is placed on gas plants, you know, I think they have to replace coal and they have to be decarbonized by 2035. Those criteria, you know, in theory are compatible with what we're seeing in these models. I think the bigger issue with that is the fact that it sends a terrible signal internationally that, you know, essentially if you skim over the details, it sends a signal that gas is green, that gas is okay, which is a potentially really damaging signal to be sending internationally. So I think in practical terms for Europe, I mean, it's not clear how much gas investment this will actually bring forward. We don't see in our modeling that gas investment stops overnight. We see that the current pipeline, you know, there's a little bit of room for further investment, but from 2025, we don't need any more. You know, we just need to keep the fleet that we have, use it less and less over time. So that's what I would say about that.
Today, I think as we speak, they will be voting in the ETREC committee in the European Parliament on the Renewables Directive. Also on the EED, I think the vote already happened. I don't know. I try to follow here. If you could give three messages to the politicians, can be only about renewables, but also about the bigger, like what would you think are the three most important things that you would like to see politicians to be decided in order to get us closer to your 2035 vision?
That's a great question. So I think on the renewables target, I know this is a renewables target for all of energy in Europe, but surely there's never been a stronger case for increasing that. I think it's currently 40 and the idea is to increase it to 45%. And, you know, I would want to emphasize to the people voting on that by accelerating wind and solar, like that really can be achieved, but it needs to be made a priority. You know, this clean power system needs to be made a priority of energy planning across Europe as the most cost effective way to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. I think on efficiency, it's the perfect partner to renewables. If our mission is to lower dependence on fossil fuels and lower fossil fuel consumption, which is, of course, a security issue as much as it is a climate issue right now. So energy efficiency is one of the fastest ways to reduce that consumption. I'm talking about insulation of buildings, renovation of buildings. That can be done much faster than building new wind farms, new solar farms, especially with the permitting issues that I was talking about earlier in the show. And the third thing I would say is, you know, the economics are really on our side. I think that's one thing that comes through very clearly from our modeling is that this is actually the cheapest way forward. And of course, there are challenges on the ground about building this and getting social consent, political consent, but this is the economic way forward. You know, if you choose anything else, a lower share of renewables, less energy efficiency, you're adding costs onto the transition, and people in Europe are already feeling the costs, aren't they, today?
Well, the trend seems to be at the moment to work with price regulation, right? We've just seen internally, I've seen a slide that actually the electricity price increased even sharper. I don't remember if it was Germany or Europe, than the gas price. So the focus seems to be at the moment on, oh my God, we need to dampen this effect. But I assume that really is not helpful on our journey to your scenario, right?
I think the questions around the energy markets, there's definitely a big risk that short-term interventions are not helpful for this longer-term transition. Of course, it's important to protect vulnerable consumers from these unprecedented prices that we're seeing now. That can be done through social policies. It doesn't necessarily require an intervention in energy markets. So I would say that interventions in energy markets should have the objective of, you know, incentivizing investment in the things that we need. So wind and solar, grids, more flexibility in general on both the supply and the demand side. It should be all about incentivizing the investment in those areas. And I think there's also an aspect here of it's quite confusing, I think, to the public. On the one hand, you have people like me saying wind and solar is insanely cheap, let's build loads of it. Then they look at their energy bill and they think, well, we've been doing that for the past years, but my energy bill is going up. So there's a risk that we kind of mismanage, you know, this moment. The message that needs to go across is that wind and solar are the path to a cheaper system. Fossil fuels are what is currently setting the high prices. And there are some interesting ideas about how to decouple that effects of gas setting the price. But that is the reason, and we need to keep saying that, I think, again and again. It's the fossil fuels in the system that are driving up these costs.
But do you think this message is being heard sufficiently? Or are we successful there? It's difficult, right?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. I think this winter there will be a big battle over this narrative.
It will get ugly, yeah.
Do you think, though, if we get to that point where we get to the a 95% clean power energy system, that these high electricity bills will be a thing of the past?
Yeah, so looking forward, we do find that to use a technical term, but the kind of system costs of these pathways come down over time as the system is increasingly dominated by cheap renewables. And, you know, those costs will effectively filter down ultimately to the consumer, either through bills or through other taxes. So it is in the benefit of everyone from a household to industry to have this cheaper and cleaner power supply. I think there are also, so that's the big picture, but that's quite academic. I would say there are also some changes that we need to see that both enable this 2035 clean power system, but also benefit consumers. And I'm talking about things like demand flexibility and actually equipping consumers with the technology and the knowledge to be able to adapt and the markets to be able to adapt their usage compared to what's available so they can use higher amounts of power at times when it's cheap and there's lots of wind and sun and less when there's not so much. And if that's done right, that could reduce the costs for consumers and allow them access to cheaper energy. That's one thing. And another thing we haven't talked about is the idea of actually local people participating in this transition in another way, which is through actually having some ownership of these new assets, these new renewable assets. So the opinion polls that have been done on the popularity of renewables show that when local benefits can be demonstrated, there's a significant boost in support for renewables. So when it comes to onshore wind and large solar farms, that could be a critical component in actually getting the consent of local people. And it will also, in theory, benefit them, benefit their back pocket.
You've mentioned cheap renewables a few times in our conversation. What does your modeling show you at the price, what the price of renewables will be up to 2035 and beyond? And how much lower is it going to get? We're already seeing wind turbine manufacturers, solar power manufacturers, and their supply chains becoming increasingly squeezed with ever reducing margins, partly due to the auction system, partly due to a whole host of factors. But there comes a point where these companies can't go on. So will there be an increase in renewables, and how does that change your modeling?
So we do assume, you're completely right, we assume that wind and solar continue to get cheaper over time. In the last few years, we've actually seen a bit of a, I wouldn't say an increase, but kind of a plateau of the costs in wind and solar. There have been some global resource supply chain issues that have caused that to happen. But we do again think that's a short-term trend, and we're not alone in that. The IEA have kind of said in their latest renewable market outlook that they expect that to be a short-term trend, and we will return to reducing costs of those technologies. But even today, new wind and solar is a lot more competitive than, for example, fossil gas. So while the cost reductions might have paused temporarily, we think, that hasn't changed the picture in comparison to fossil fuels. The competitiveness relatively has actually only increased compared to the alternatives.
One of the conclusions from the report was that clean power pathways allows direct electrification to reach 40 to 47% by 2035 compared to around 30% under stated policies. What needs to happen in order to support this expansion, or could it happen through just market forces, or does there need to be some sort of government intervention or regulatory intervention there?
Yeah, I think the case for electrification is very strong. First thing I would say is in these pathways, that isn't a forecast for what electrification will become. That's just what we think it could be by 2035. And it will be higher. We think it could be higher as we go beyond that as well. And I think it's worth maybe just explaining why we think that is the path that should be taken. So in many cases, what you get when you replace fossil fuels with electricity is you get an immediate increase in efficiency. So, a heat pump is three times more efficient than a gas boiler. An electric vehicle, roughly speaking, is three times more efficient than a internal combustion engine vehicle. So you immediately get an efficiency boost, which makes a lot of economic sense. And just practically speaking as well, with those end uses, clean electricity is right now one of the most scalable and accessible forms of decarbonization in those areas. So going back to your question about whether this will actually happen and what's needed to make that happen, I think it varies by sector. I think the sector that we have to worry the least about maybe is transport. And I'm not an expert here, but what I see is the share of electric vehicles going up faster than many people expected over the last few years. The share of new registrations now is creeping towards 10-20% in a lot of countries. So I think I think this seems to be happening, as you say, by kind of market forces, also helped by some bans on conventional combustion engine vehicles. On heating, I think maybe the most difficult of these, and I'm sure if Jan was here, he could expand on this. And you may have covered this already in previous episodes, but you know, the deployment of heat pumps often needs to go together with renovation or efficiency improvements in buildings, and you know, these are quite, at the moment, these are quite sort of capital intensive things to do. So I think there is a clear role for government here in kind of allowing this to happen. And as I said earlier, you know, efficiency improvements, one of the quickest wins you can have in terms of reducing reliance on gas and gas consumption. So, I mean, there's co-benefits there for other reasons. But what we need to see, I think, is bans on gas boilers in new buildings, improved building standards, and yeah, support schemes for renovation and insulation, which we're seeing in some countries. But I mean, to come back to the UK, you know, we're really falling badly behind in that area. And I think industry is probably the most complicated in terms of trying to forecast where this is going in terms of its fuel mix. But what I would say is the incentives to electrify don't seem to be there. We've seen pretty slow progress in that respect. Maybe the high fossil fuel prices that we're seeing now, maybe an effect of that on industry might be to accelerate this thinking about how they can move beyond fossil fuels and into the alternatives. But yeah, I think there is a big potential prize there because industry is a large consumer of power and relatively centralized. So if you can turn that into a flexible consumer and a consumer that increasingly wants to have clean power, then potentially there's quite an important driver there for decarbonizing the power system. Cleaning it up.
Yeah, absolutely. A final question just before we wrap up. Your report calls for a paradigm shift in the way the power system is operated. So what do you see that needs to change? And is that the role of the grid operators and how their role is going to shift in the next sort of 15, 20 years?
Yeah, I would expand this point to a paradigm shift in the way the power system is operated and planned. And I think right now the planning part of that is really important. So what we want to do with this report and our kind of analysis on clean power systems is to really show that this wind and solar dominated system, you know, it's the economics make so much sense. The climate imperatives line up as well. You know, we want to say like this is coming. This is what it looks like. You'll need to be, as a system operator, you'll need to be managing hours of the year where the grid is fully powered by wind and solar. I think the good news is that we have the technology to handle that on the grid level, you know. But again, these things have lead times. You need preparation to do trials, and given the short timescales, you know, we're talking about 13 years time to reach this decarbonized power system. Like, this really needs to be happening now. So the planning for this needs to be happening now. It needs to be anticipated. And these grid strengthening and grid adaptation measures need to be put in, taken seriously. And that all starts with planning. You know, we're still seeing system operators across Europe publishing their future scenarios. And there's coal in 2040. There's more gas by 2035. You know, it's just not in any way realistic if we're going to meet the Paris Agreement. So it needs to start with the planning. And then the operating, because we'll need to have a much more flexible demand side, I think it's clear there needs to be more coordination between the distribution level that's going into people's homes and the transmission level, which is kind of the motorways of power across countries. We need to see a more integrated approach in how to manage the system. And we need to anticipate, look forward to what the needs will be, what the challenges will be in this kind of more flexible system, and start putting plans in place now to actually make that work in quite a short time.
Absolutely. Chris, thank you so much. That was really interesting. I would recommend everyone read the report. Before we go then, one thing we ask all of our guests is if they could look into their crystal ball, what would they see the energy system looking like in 10 to 20 years' time? Obviously, we've covered that quite in depth with your report. So I imagine I'm going to change it slightly. It's like, what would you like to see the energy system being like in 10 to 20 years' time?
That's a great question. So I would like to see that Europe has succeeded on this mission that we're setting out in this report. If it does, then it will have set a really important precedent for the rest of the world, showing that it can be done, it's feasible, it can be achieved. And if we do get there, I would like to see consumers really being part of this transition and having access to this clean, cheap electricity, being able to use that flexibly and generally reaping the benefits of a clean power system, this cheap, abundant, clean energy. And I also think that if we do that, then we'll have achieved the social consent for renewables, we'll have won that kind of public, that public case for renewables. And again, big lessons to learn there for the rest of the world if that can be achieved in Europe.
Absolutely, 100%. That sounds really interesting there. Finally, then, let's quickly go around the table and see what caught our eye this week, something that's really stuck with us, something that really captured our attention around the energy transition. Michaela, what caught your eye this week?
Ha, I'm first, because I thought if I'm not, then someone else steals the 1,000 euros per megawatt hour that was tweeted over this week for the French nuclear forward for the end of the year. But apart from that, what I also saw is the new project announcement for the Innovation Fund yesterday. I think there's some really interesting stuff in there, also offshore batteries, but also new stuff like, you know, cement, carbon capturing and cement, etc. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Really interesting. Chris, what caught your eye this week?
My attention was caught by, I apologize in advance, but it is also about modeling, but it's not just the power sector this time. So the Zero Lab in Princeton in the US did a really interesting study looking at the gas grid and the power grid in Europe. And what they found is that actually this year, I think by October this year, Europe could be completely independent of imports of Russian gas. So this is something that the Repower EU plan, it takes until 2027 to achieve that same objective. So this is really cutting edge modeling. It's coming out with quite a powerful finding that this year we can cut those ties with Russia in terms of gas. And just to very briefly explain how that's done, they see the need for a temporary increase in the use of coal, which we're already seeing. But I think really interestingly, they also strongly call for accelerating renewables. Again and again, we come back to this issue of accelerating renewables. And they also call for, again, a temporary reduction in power demand, which is something that I hadn't really seen spoken about in many other areas. The discussion is often about turning down thermostats and reducing gas consumption in industry and homes. But this is, it seems to be calling for a more broad reduction in power consumption, which is interesting. So that caught my attention.
Yeah, really interesting. We'll have links for all of those in our show notes if you want to read more. For me, I was a New York Times article looking at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, which obviously is going through a huge renovation after a devastating fire a couple of years ago. But what they're doing around the cathedral is to help with cooling within the city. So we're recording this on one of the hottest days of the year. So I'm really interested in how we're going to make our cities cooler. But they're in. So, as part of the renovation of the cathedral, they're planting over 30% more vegetation around the area to provide shade. They're changing a parking lot to become an underground walkway that opens onto the banks of the Seine. And they're also going to put in a cooling system that will send a 5 millimeter thin sheet of water, roughly 1/5 of an inch, streaming down the square in front of the cathedral. Enough to lower temperatures around the cathedral by a few degrees without actually flooding the area. So I'm really interested in finding these new ways that these cities are going to adapt to climate change.
This is cool. I didn't read about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And obviously, they're taking the opportunity with the renovation of the cathedral to really make a few changes around the area as well. So really interesting stuff. And hopefully, I'll go visit when the cathedral is reopened in a couple of years' time. But so I say.
Can't believe the podcast ends with a reference to the Notre Dame. Come on.
Would you have thought when you woke up this morning you'd be talking about the Notre Dame Cathedral? Sadly, that is all we have time for today. My thanks to Chris, Michaela, and our producer, Anna. If you have any thoughts or questions about anything we have said on today's podcast, you can reach us on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @DaveW_Foresight. Chris?
I'm at CK Roslow.
And Michaela?
I'm at Citizen Sane 1.
If you have any questions for the team, or you can tweet the show @WhatMattersPod or email us at show@WhatMattersPodcast.com. We're going to be taking a short break over the summer, but we'll be back in September with more episodes and more fascinating guests taking a deep dive into the energy transition. So we hope to see you then. Thank you.